Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, Urien Timmer, joins us again for a Global Macro and Markets Update. In today's podcast, recorded on November 23rd, 2020, Urien and host Pamela Ritchie discuss the market's reaction to the latest vaccine and election news. Urien also dives into the topics of fiscal stimulus, oil, and emerging markets. And Urien shares his thoughts on the traditional 60-40 portfolio in today's market environment and money currently on the sidelines in money market funds. For more of Urien's insights, you can follow him on LinkedIn or on Twitter at TimmerFidelity. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Great to see you, Urien. Welcome.
Good morning, Pamela.
Urien, I wonder if we begin with, we're actually seeing AstraZeneca's price down a little bit. This is one of the vaccine makers, there's been many, in the good news about their vaccine. Is good news priced into the markets, I guess, broadly speaking?
It's getting there, but I would say that, you know, everyone is still a little bit on pins and needles in terms of, you know, what does it mean? When does the economy reopen? When do we get our lives back? You know, will the end of 2020 really be the end of 2020? And there's other nuances, because in a way it's a little bit of a catch-22, because with the COVID cases obviously skyrocketing all around us, and it's very, you know, saddening and disturbing to see to what degree the wave count is up. You know, normally you would expect to see much more urgency behind getting more fiscal relief, because obviously if you have rising cases, it delays the reopen. We're seeing it, you know, I'm in California, and, you know, lots more measures being taken to restrict people's flow. I think in LA, they just are closing indoor and outdoor dining. So a lot of restrictions being taken place that obviously delays the reopen, and therefore that requires more fiscal relief. But then you have this juxtaposition with very promising news on vaccines. I'm hearing they could start getting rollout in the next few weeks even. But that takes kind of the urgency off of more fiscal relief. And of course, we have Washington being still in a very dysfunctional state, as we all know. And so people are not really working together over there right now to get fiscal relief going. So it's a bit of a catch-22 that it's great that we may reopen sooner because of vaccines, but it also diminishes the urgency again behind fiscal. And that then plays into the rotation in the markets.
We're hearing some whispers, it seems, out of Washington this week. Each week's a bit different on the fiscal stimulus front, but it sounds like they might be working towards a smaller bill in the neighborhood of $500 billion, taking the trillions out of the question for now. And, you know, no one really knows what that'll be. I know you don't either. But what does it do for the market, you know, a smaller bridge, for instance?
I mean, a smaller bridge is better than no bridge, because a lot of these benefits are going to be running out at the end of the year. So there will need to be something. But you know, this is where it becomes really tricky for the markets, because we don't know yet which party will control the Senate. We have two runoff Senate races in Georgia that are extremely tight. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing, because if there's less fiscal relief now, and I wouldn't call it stimulus, but really fiscal relief, so transfer payments to people who don't have any income, you know, that's fine if then there's a promise that, you know, the Democrats take over on January 21st, and then, you know, multiple trillions come in then. But we don't really know if that's even going to happen, because if the Senate remains Republican, then that's probably not going to happen. Maybe there'll be something, but certainly not in the orders of magnitude that I think the markets, or at least the value side of the markets, would like to see. So some relief is better than no relief, but we were talking about 2 trillion of relief, you know, just a few weeks ago. And if we go from 2 trillion to 500 billion, that's something that the market needs to price in. And again, the offset of vaccines is an important offset to that. So it's not, you know, a one-dimensional argument to make. But I think that's what the market is kind of struggling with here. And that's why really in the last few weeks, there hasn't really been a lot of action in terms of the S&P. It's been flat for several weeks now. And even with growth to value, or, you know, the stay at home stocks versus the reopen stocks, everything is kind of flatlining while we sort of wait for more information, I guess.
Yeah. Put some sort of some brackets around, I guess, the action in oil today. We're seeing crude rally. We've actually seen contango be pretty quickly reduced. Like, what a rate of reduction. That's obviously the further out prices versus today's prices. What do you think of oil right now?
Yeah, so oil is at $43 for WTI. It was, of course, minus $40 back in April for a brief second when we had that crazy, crazy action going on. And again, it's like, you know, it has to be 2020 that all these things happen, because if you start seeing some crazy stuff, you might as well see all of it. And certainly minus $40 was one of them. So we went from minus 40 to plus 40. But we've been at plus 40, more or less, give or take a few dollars, for the last 7 months. So the oil market, like everyone else, is waiting for the reopen, right? And actually, you know, Bloomberg puts out this really cool data showing the kind of a daily activity indicator. And it's kind of, I liken it to the output gap, which I've shown here in the past. You know, the output gap pre-COVID was plus 1.2%. In other words, the economy was running beyond capacity for a while. Then in the second quarter, it fell to minus 10%. And then in the third quarter, it improved to minus 3.5%, which is a huge improvement, you know, and certainly it proved the market right at the time that the market, which was kind of ahead of that whole thing and was being blamed for being disconnected from reality, the market actually was correctly anticipating a V-shaped recovery in the economy. And so, you know, the market gets credit for that. But now we're in this point where the output gap is still minus 3.5, or if you look at it on this daily activity tracker and you start on the left kind of at 100, or the pre-COVID starting point, you fell all the way to 25 in some countries, 35 in others. We've made up a lot of that ground. China has made up actually all of the ground, and other Asian countries have as well. But the US and Europe remain fairly far behind, and actually have been dipping in recent weeks. And so, you know, we've recovered sort of three quarters of the decline. But that remaining one quarter, that really is the tricky part. You know, how linear and how quick do we have that remaining recovery to full employment and full capacity? Or does it become much more of a jagged kind of, you know, line where you've got promising news on vaccines, but then you get more case counts? And how do you juxtapose these different ones? And I think oil, it's kind of the same stories. When we have clarity of vaccines, how many doses can be made, how many people will need it? Remember, not everyone needs it, right? Because people who've already gotten COVID will presumably have the antibodies. Young people probably don't need a vaccine if the at-risk population is getting it. So we may need fewer doses than maybe people think, but all of that stuff is kind of coming into the forefront now. And I think this line eventually goes up, and with it, so does crude oil, and so do commodity prices in general, and so does value relative to growth. I think that the 2021 will be a continuation of the value and cyclicals and small cap trade. EM is part of that, or non-US stocks are part of that as well. And so I do think that that continues, but I think we're kind of waiting for more information right now.
You have answered just exactly what today's poll is about asking. So the most important topics I want to hear about: one is value versus growth, and two is US versus, you know, not US, essentially. So that's interesting. Let's delve a bit further in there. You've talked about this, and as you say, it's a continuing situation. any subtleties to know within so-called developed markets versus, you know, where are we talking about? We're seeing Europe on the developed market side do, it looks like, relatively well. When you speak of EM, break that down for us. Where are you speaking about? Yeah.
Well, certainly a centerpiece of this whole discussion is the dollar and the Fed's ability to keep things very accommodative. And I think the Fed is very much committed to that, especially if the fiscal side is now starting to waver, that puts even more burden on the Fed to keep things very loose. And, you know, and I'm hearing stories about, you know, when is the Fed going to tighten? And I think that's, we don't really have to worry about that conversation for, I think, several years. And I think the Chair Powell has made that pretty clear. But, you know, I've been bullish on emerging markets. And as we discussed, I think last week, my approach to asset allocation, at least personally, is kind of this barbell approach where I don't really want to bet against the big U.S. growth companies because they continue to produce lots of free cash flow. And maybe with a more divided government, there is slightly less regulatory risk on big tech. But I really want to play the value side, the deep value side. And I also want to be short the dollar. And so for me, the way to do that is to have the other side of the barbell on the growth value side really be non-U.S. stocks in general, because those stocks, I mean, EM is becoming more growthy now than it used to be. But generally speaking, non-US stocks are a little bit more old economy, and the US is more new economy. And old economy, of course, is where the value side is. I have a lot of conviction on this. It doesn't have to be EM. It could just be non-US. And that, again, the function of a weaker dollar, a very accommodative Fed, which will likely remain accommodative for a number of years, I think plays well into this as the world, you know, gradually starts to reopen, hopefully in 2021.
Let's just go a bit further with the discussion around the Fed being accommodative, and just go slightly political here just because it's fun for a second. There are a lot of names being circulated for Treasury Secretary under a Biden administration. Nobody knows which one's going to be chosen, but Lael Brainard, as well as Janet Yellen, clearly are close Fed candidates. Their names seem to be going around. There's some other names too. Regardless, we don't know who it will be. But is it fair to think that a Biden presidency might well work ever more closely with the Fed? I mean, that's really the broad question.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that would have happened no matter who would have won or who is going to win. I think we know who's won, but yeah, you never know these days. So I think, you know, when a country has aging demographics and therefore a downtrending potential output. So in other words, when your demographics slow, you have less ability to grow out of debt. And so you have that, and you have already extremely high debt levels as we, you know, right now as it is. The U.S., I think, is going to end up at about 125% debt to GDP, and that's just federal debt. That's not even counting all the other debts. If you add everything, we're probably at 350% debt to GDP. And, you know, in the past, sometimes you're able to grow out of that debt, like we did in the 40s, but in the U.S. But with the demographic story being what it is, that's probably not going to work. And so obviously no one's going to default out of debt because nobody does that anymore. You can't grow your way out of debt. So you have to basically inflate your way out of debt by pushing down real rates to negative levels and doing quantitative easing and just kind of pegging rates at really low levels. And I think that requires a coordination between fiscal and monetary authorities. We saw that in the 40s. You know, the U.S. Government ran up the debt fourfold, and the Fed increased its balance sheet 10 times, tenfold, while keeping rates well below the inflation rate. And so whether it will ever be overtly stated, it probably won't be. My guess is that there will be more coordination. And, you know, Jay Powell has been saying we need more fiscal. We can't do this alone. And so if Biden puts in someone like Janet Yellen, who is obviously extremely well respected, I've seen her speak many times post her Fed job. And I think that would really be cheered on by the market. So knowing Biden, I don't know Biden, but knowing his kind of his bipartisan way of dealing with things, I would be surprised that he would put someone like an Elizabeth Warren in that spot, and probably would be picking someone who can, you know, kind of bridge the divide of all the sides in the government as well as Wall Street.
Yeah, interesting one to watch. So there's a few announcements it looks like coming out this week on that front. A number of questions coming in here. You're in. One of them is, can you expand on what or which financial conditions you're closely watching in the United States right now?
Yeah, so the general definition of financial conditions, I use the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index, and it's basically based on five things, I think. It's the dollar, equity prices, credit spreads, short rates, and long rates. And pretty much on all of those bases, except for long rates, which have been rising, but still are very, very low. We're at 85 basis points today. And even if long rates in the U.S. went to 1.25, which, by the way, the copper gold ratio suggests it should, that's still a really low level. So you have the dollar down, credit spreads are very tight. The high yield spreads are now among the tightest they've ever been. Short rates, obviously, at 0.125% or 0% are going to stay that way. And equity prices are rising. So all of those feed into financial conditions being very, very supportive for risk assets. And especially EM tends to be very sensitive because when financial conditions loosen in the U.S., EM is one of the highest sort of beta plays on that happening.
Does gold have a place right now?
I'm a gold bull, but I'm not a rabid bull. Yeah. There's a distinction there to be made. You know, a friend of mine once said that there's no fever like gold fever, and maybe we can just call that Bitcoin fever now, that people who are believers are going to be believers, even if they are proven wrong for 10 years at a time. But, you know, gold has a place for sure, because if it's a big if, but if U.S. policymakers are able to generate structural inflation, and again, the pathway, in my opinion, would be, let's say the Democrats do take the Senate, right? They win the two Georgia races, and then Kamala Harris becomes a deciding vote in the Senate, and they do unleash, you know, $7 trillion of fiscal stimulus in the coming years, and that is able to boost the money supply, because the pendulum then swings from capital to labor. And you know, if the money supply is boosted long enough by enough of a margin, you could argue that inflation will eventually follow. If we're then at a point where the Fed will not respond to that rising inflation by raising interest rates, right, which would be the playbook from the 1940s, and that's something we've talked about a number of times. So if the Fed then keeps rates below the inflation rate, because that's really the only way you can get out of debt is through negative rates. It's almost like an invisible tax on bondholders, if you will. then you get into a scenario where it's extremely constructive for gold prices, because you're kind of debasing the monetary system at that point. I mean, again, no one at the Fed would ever call it that. So there is a place for gold, but right now gold is sort of on hold. My guess is, and this is purely anecdotal, but my guess is that gold is losing some of its shine, no pun intended, against Bitcoin, that Bitcoin is seen as a more practical form of gold, right? Because remember, if you're one of these diehard gold bulls and you think that eventually we're going to be paying for our goods with gold instead of with paper money, doing that with Bitcoin actually makes a lot more sense, because you're not carrying around gold coins, you know, trying to pay for your haircut, right? Then you just, it becomes a digital thing. So that's purely my own sense. I don't have hard data to back that up. But my guess is that whoever has been bullish on gold is liking the Bitcoin story more. And of course, it's also a momentum story. Nothing changes sentiment like the price action, right? So everyone becomes a believer at 19,000 all of a sudden. But right now, gold is a little bit on hold because you do need that inflation to work, right? Because rates are already very low. They can't really go much lower. And so if inflation does not actually manifest through, again, this fiscal monetary cocktail that would happen in a Democratic, you know, blue wave in 2021, then the gold story kind of falls apart a little bit. And that, which is not to mean that it becomes a bearer story, but it doesn't get the fuel to make new highs, because you need that inflation. You need those negative real rates to get more negative, and that that scenario is not immediately on the horizon until we know who's going to run the U.S. Senate come January.
Typically at the end of the year, there's rebalancing going on. You and I brought up, I think, I forget the Mark Twain saying that you said, but basically that the 60-40 is alive and kicking on some level. There's a thought that, you know, big funds and so on rebalancing into sort of the 60-40 model. What does that do to some of the stock market dynamics with so-called retail investors, you know, more present in the market? Does that make it more volatile, this yearly rebalancing situation?
So the rebalancing happens every quarter, basically, among pension funds, certainly. And this was a big story back in April, I guess it was, right? We had been looking for that bottom in late March. And then you had a very large move down in equities, a very large up move in bonds, in bond prices or bond returns. And so, you know, a 60-40 in February became a 50-50 in March. And so if you're a large pension fund, and again, there's, you know, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, you know, earmarked to this, including, you know, our funds at Fidelity. We all rebalance. So there was a large rebalancing in April into equities out of bonds. And it turned out that was, you know, it was like in the tens of billions, that rebalance. There's a little bit of that going on right now. It's almost the end of November. The market is up. Bond yields are up. And so you should see some rebalancing into, out of equities into bonds. And so maybe that's another reason why the market is kind of just on hold here. You know, the S&P really hasn't done anything in the last few weeks. So there's always that rebalancing. Pension funds are not going to be heroes about, you know, letting the asset allocation run well beyond their benchmark. I don't think it's so much of a retail thing, unless retail is in a fund like at Fidelity or through an investment advisor, where that fund will then rebalance, you know, on their behalf. So the rebalancing is there. It's not nearly as big now, I think, as it was in the spring, just because of the magnitude of the moves back then. We're seeing some moves like that, but it's really a quarter to quarter thing, and not necessarily a year end thing, unless there is an index rebalancing, which then forces investors to move around some of their assets.
I don't know if we have time to hit these two points, but I'd like to hit on sentiment and just the idea that there's still lots of money on the sidelines. We're watching flows in certain areas. And I also want to ask you about the story that's not over yet, which is Brexit. Let's see if we can get them both in there. Maybe we begin with some of the flows that we've seen and just sort of what's on the sidelines still.
I find this very amusing, you know, because I've been tracking sentiment for my whole career. And one of the things that I've been pointing out for many years is that the bull market that started in 2009 with the financial crisis, the end of the financial crisis, has been one of the most unloved bull markets, you know, ever. That bull market, you know, until the COVID peak, saw a quintupling of asset prices, right, of stock prices, and it actually produced outflows from equities. And then, of course, COVID happens. We saw more outflows. Again, slide six should speak to that. And then last week we saw, it was widely reported that there was $53 billion in inflows. And, you know, the contrarian in everyone immediately starts to get all excited, saying, oh, that means that retail is all in and you got to ring the bell because everyone is in. And I'm like, not so fast. You know, $53 billion is a big number. But compared to, you know, the $5 trillion sitting in money market funds and the hundreds of billions going in and out of bond funds and money market funds, you know, equity funds taking in 50 or 100 billion after years of outflow is not really a big deal for me. It is a recognition that investors are starting to realize that there is a light at the end of the tunnel from COVID. So maybe you're seeing it that way. Yes.
One word answer on Brexit. Does it go through? Does it not? How about do you care? Any of the.
I had Brexit fatigue a year ago, and now I have so many other fatigues in addition to that, mostly politically related, that I'm having trouble even remembering what's happening on Brexit. But obviously, it's important. It's important if you're a UK-based or a European investor. It has implications for asset allocation, but it's kind of a Europe story, and there are so many other stories going on, obviously around COVID, but also the U.S. election and what that means for fiscal policy. And again, to me, the biggest thing that we need to be on top of as investors is this notion of fiscal monetary coordination, or a cocktail, as I call it, and to what degree we will see that, and to what degree that will impact asset prices, but especially below the surface, you know, stocks versus bonds, growth versus value, financial assets versus real assets. So there's a lot of wood to chop there, and I think to me that's the overarching theme here. Brexit is certainly important, but these other stories are more important.
You always give us a great sort of checklist of what we need to be focusing on this week. Thank you. And maybe next week we'll have a Treasury Secretary, a new one on the horizon to discuss. We shall see.
I think we will. We should, yeah.
All the best for a great week. Thank you, Yuri and Timur.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.